So since there's a number of you that have not joined us before, and I don't know too much about what your familiarity is with meditation or with the Buddhist Dharma that the meditation comes from, and so I'd be really happy to answer any questions that anybody has or satisfy any curiosities or whatever I can. One thing maybe I'll make clear at the outset that isn't obvious is that although we do some chanting and a certain amount of ritual, this is not essentially a religious practice in any particular way. Although there are many Buddhist religions in the world, most of what we do as a group dates back to the teachings of the original Buddha, and we tend to disregard a lot of the cultural accretions and the religious elements that have been introduced into Buddhism. What could I possibly tell any of you or help you to understand or help you with your meditation if you're I'd like to know, for those of you that are here for the first time, if you have a meditation practice, if you've meditated before, your thoughts on meditation, so on and so forth.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sue. I've done Transcendental Meditation through Perry and Unity through the Unity Church and the Edgar Cayce readings. Mm-hmm. And my continuing challenge is that I get to the point where the mind is so distracted that it's really, I end up giving up on it.
Yes, yes. I've heard that before. Yeah. Well, yeah. What I teach is a systematic method that starts off by acknowledging exactly the way the mind behaves and lays out a series of steps by which you can systematically overcome that kind of obstacle. It's universal that you sit down and you, no matter what meditation practice you begin to engage in, that there are all kinds of distractions that enter your mind. Some of them are potent enough that they capture your attention. Having captured your attention and caused you to totally forget why you were sitting there, they tend to lead to long, drawn-out periods of mind wandering in which, you know, when you're finished with a distraction, it makes you think of something else, or something else comes into your mind, and so you sit there for a long period of time and with a lot of distraction happening. The other thing that very often happens when people undertake meditation is that they sit down, they find themselves nodding off and going to sleep. And so there are ways of overcoming both of those things and achieving the kind of clarity of mind and peace of mind that allows you not to get captured and lost in these distractions, or to fall asleep. And it's achieved by recognizing the nature of the mind and the way it works and take advantage of it. For example, the sequence of what happens is you're sitting there doing whatever meditation practice you're doing, and there's these distractions coming and going, but they don't quite capture your attention. Or if they do, it's only for a relatively short period of time. But sooner or later, one of them captures your attention strongly enough and long enough that you forget what you're doing, and you're just sitting there thinking about something. And so the presence of the distractions leads to forgetting. Once you've forgotten what you're doing, your mind's going to do what it always does, and when it finishes with one thought, and then move on to another. I call that mind wandering. But then something very interesting always happens after that. The next event is that you suddenly realize that you've been sitting there thinking about a whole lot of nonsense while you meant to be meditating. You've had that experience, right? That's the one that tends to get neglected, but that's the one that's most important. Because an unconscious part of your mind has caused you, has recognized that, hey, you know, you sat down with the intention to meditate and now you're doing this other thing. And it made you consciously aware of it. And the experience is kind of like waking up. It's as if you had been in a dream. So that's the feeling you have, right? Yeah, that's exactly what I feel like. You'd been in a dream and all of a sudden you're awake and you're alert and you're present and you know where you are and you know what it is, what you know why you're there and what it is you intended to be doing. Now that's really wonderful. And that's the key to shortening those periods of mind wandering. Of course, what we usually do in that moment is get annoyed at ourselves or annoyed at our unruly mind or something and immediately go back to the meditation. And that's totally the wrong thing to do, because what we're doing is it's a kind of self-punishment. So we're giving some negative feedback immediately following the one thing that we would like to have sooner, happen sooner and more often. So you do something different. When you have that experience of waking up to being in the present, you appreciate it, you enjoy it, you say, wow, this is wonderful, I'd like to be like this all the time, this is great. You know, whatever part of your mind it is that woke you up to what you intended to be doing and brought you back to the present, you don't want to get mad at it. You want to celebrate it, pat it on the back, congratulate it, say, wow, great, do that again. Then go back to your meditation and try to maintain that state of alert presentness as long as you can. And of course, the same events will happen over and over again. But you see, if you repeat this process often enough, those periods of mind wandering will get shorter and shorter. They'll get short enough so that although a distraction may capture you and you may briefly forget what it was you were supposed to be doing, you'll come back into the present before it's led to mind wandering. Now you've made a lot of really great progress. And the other thing that will happen is that an initial experience, and this may be what you're familiar with, is that you sit down to meditate, you're good for the meditation for anywhere from a few seconds to a couple of minutes, and then the forgetting and mind wandering happens, and then you go back and you start again, and once again, it could be as short as if you're meditating on the breath, it could be as little as two breaths before you're gone again, or at best you might get a minute or two in, you know. But what happens if you do what I've just described is those periods get longer and longer till, you know, and you start taking advantage of those periods there. There's a really important thing when people talk about meditation, they use the words attention and awareness. And there's a failure to recognize that attention, that there are two distinct ways we have of knowing. In any moment when we're conscious, in the situation that you're conscious of right now, there are two different ways that you have of knowing. And what I do is I use the word attention exclusively to refer to when your mind picks out one particular thing and focuses on it. And I use awareness or peripheral awareness to describe what's happening at exactly the same time when you still know about all of these other things. So when you're sitting there and meditating, you want to focus your attention on your meditation object. If you're meditating on the breath, then it's the sensations of the breath. So what you would like to happen is that your that your attention be anchored to your meditation object. And there's actually nothing really wonderful about your meditation object. What's wonderful is that when your attention remains focused on your meditation object, this other aspect of this other way of knowing, this peripheral awareness, begins to expand and becomes very powerful. And that's what you want to do. You want awareness has its own job to do in the functioning of the mind and in our lives. And attention has its own job to do. But we have two problems. One is that we overuse attention and we really have no idea how to use our peripheral awareness effectively. In other words, we all suffer from awareness deficit disorder. A different kind of ADD. Not attention deficit disorder, but awareness deficit disorder. But we also have something in common. We all have a degree of attention deficit disorder in that our attention is always bouncing around from one thing to another, to another, to another, right? When you want to develop awareness, you have to stabilize attention. And a good way to understand what I'm saying, to get the meaning of this, is just compare it with vision. So visually, you can focus on something, pick something on the other side of the room and focus your eyes on it, and you'll see everything else in peripheral vision, and that's how peripheral awareness is. Now, if the focus of your vision is bouncing around from one thing to another, you don't have that same experience of peripheral awareness. You need a bit of stability for the peripheral awareness. But your peripheral awareness is quite powerful. Now, your peripheral vision is quite powerful. Your peripheral awareness is quite powerful. In its own special, unique ways, which are very important. The most important thing that you can do with your peripheral awareness is to make it introspective, to make it deeply introspective, so that you begin to see into the very nature of your own mind. And because of that, you have the opportunity to see into the nature of reality itself, because that is the only access we have. We think about there's the world out there and all these things that are happening out there, and then there's my mind where my thoughts and my emotions and my stuff, my personal stuff happens. But one of the things that you learn when you meditate very quickly is actually it's not like that at all. There's your consciousness, and stuff enters consciousness through your sense organs, and stuff enters your consciousness from the unconscious parts of your mind. And so really, your only access to reality, to the true nature of things, is via what appears in consciousness. Because if it's not in consciousness, might as well not exist. And so it is by looking inward and seeing and observing the behavior of your mind from the only vantage point you have, which is what appears in consciousness, that you come to understand your mind, and by understanding your mind, to have deep insight into the true nature of the reality that you're a part of. And that's what this is all about. Ultimately leads to the kind of transformation in our understanding that's called awakening, or by some people enlightenment and things like that. But it all comes down to learn to stabilize your attention enough to develop your peripheral awareness. And peripheral awareness is naturally and most easily peripheral awareness of the things going on around you. But you learn to turn that inward, so it becomes introspective awareness. And then eventually it becomes the kind of introspective awareness that we call metacognitive. And what that means, it's when the vantage point of your awareness is, it's as though it's from a higher perspective that allows you to observe your own mind in its totality. The same way that, you know, you're standing here on the ground and all you see is the tree in front of you and the rocks beside you, but you climb up on a hill and you, oh, I see the whole picture. So metacognitive introspective awareness allows you to see your mind in that same kind of way. But it's very hard to get to that experience when every time you sit down to meditate, you either doze off or end up in extended periods of mind wandering. And so really the first thing that you want to do is to learn to overcome the distractions and the mind wandering. And there are two ways of doing that. One is somebody tells you a meditation technique, it's usually a very brief instruction, and says, keep on doing that and do it over and over again every day, and eventually, if you're lucky, you'll get past distractions and dullness. The other way is to use very specific techniques and understanding, taking advantage of the understanding of the mind that people have traveled this path before you, to break the problem down into specific obstacles and specific practices that you can do to overcome those obstacles. And what I described to you earlier was, this was the very first obstacle that every meditator encounters, and one of the very first methods that you can use for overcoming that obstacle. So there's a series of these, and if you follow them systematically, you will fairly quickly, much more quickly than just sitting down and doing the same thing over and over again, overcome distraction and dullness and get to this place of stability and clarity of your mind. Once your mind becomes stable, once it's not so, you know, one of the things that you notice when you meditate is that the enormous amount of useless crap that your mind generates, right? You rethink things that you've already rethought so many times that there's no possibility that you're going to come up with newer value. Or you find your mind going over stuff that, you know, is just totally irrelevant to your life and everything else, but your mind does it anyway. You know, or, you know, all the other forms of nonsense. You know what I'm talking about. So one of the wonderful things that happens is that after a while in your meditation, all that noise, and that's really the best way to describe it, all that useless noise quiets down. And then some really amazing things begin to emerge from your deep unconscious into consciousness, where you can see them, learn things about yourself and why you are the way you are. And actually, by observing these things, you transform how your mind works at a deep unconscious level. You can overcome a lot of bad habits, undesirable personality traits, what we call personality traits, or, you know, dispositions to react in certain ways to certain kinds of situations. And all of us have some of those that we wish we didn't. And in meditation, the things about our past history that are responsible for creating and maintaining those particular dispositions come to the surface. And when they do, it gives you an opportunity to purify your mind of those, or reintegrate the parts of your unconscious mind that have kept making this thing happen over and over again. So you reintegrate that in with the rest of who you are and your, you know, where you are in your current understanding. A lot of this stuff comes from your childhood, your adolescence, unfortunate things that happened to you along the way. It left an imprint that caused you to behave in particular ways. But when those come up in meditation, you can transform them in such a way that they no longer create the problems that they once did. And that part of your mind, that was responsible for making you always either be angry or afraid or whatever it was in that particular set of circumstances, now becomes your ally rather than your enemy. So that's just a little bit that I can say about meditation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jody.
Yes.
I come from Maine.
Welcome.
Thank you. I have done some meditation. I used to do it very regularly, transcendental meditation mm-hmm. also. Then did a little bit of study with Thich Nhat Hanh. And my major practice is Tai Chi, moving meditation, which I practice in. Teach, and I go to week-long camps and sometimes shorter things with my main teacher, and we do a kind of Buddhist meditation at the beginning and end of the day at those camps. So those are some of my experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'm just here because it seems very you know, we just arrived yesterday and found out this was happening. Like, okay, I guess mm-hmm. you're supposed to be here. So
yeah.
I'm very interested to just... We were here 2 years ago, my friend mm-hmm. Carol and I, and yeah. we came into the meditation... You weren't here. You were off somewhere, but we came into the meditation hut, and I just felt unbelievable clear energy, and the mm-hmm. magic of this whole place is amazing. So I'm just interested in... hearing whatever, mm-hmm. taking in whatever's going on.
Well, it's lovely to have you here, and I'm really happy that you have some meditation practices that you do. There are many different kinds of meditation practices, of course, and there's many different reasons for meditating. A lot of people meditate for relaxation and stress reduction. Sometimes people meditate to get to that place of calm and clarity and tranquility, but you know, they don't think in much in terms of where it might go from there. I think most people are aware that pretty well every meditation technique has originated in some tradition or another for the purpose of bringing people to a state of awakening or enlightenment, to a state of dramatic transformation in their understanding of themselves and the world around them that allows them to be much happier and well-grounded and to possess a sort of profound wisdom. But I think it's very common for most people to believe, and to have been told this, to have this belief reinforced, that, well, that goal of becoming awakened, enlightened, transformed in this really dramatic way, you know, of and Christian church of achieving that kind of sainthood or so forth as being this wonderful but completely unreachable and not really much point in my going after that. So what they're doing is they're enjoying all the kind of fringe they're meditating for the sake of all the kinds of fringe benefits that come with these practices if you do them without really aiming towards what the practice was originally intended to take them towards. Both of you have done TEM. I did TEM for a period of time and was going to become a teacher in the TEM tradition. I began that process. It's a fairly lengthy process, as you may know. But I discovered the Buddhist method of meditation, and I found that it was what I thought a much more powerful and effective approach. And not only that, the people that I learned it from presented it with a promise that if I really wanted to and was willing to put the time and effort in, that awakening wasn't some wonderful but basically unreachable ideal, but rather something that was quite within the reach of just about any human being who was willing to go for it. And actually, the interesting thing is the refuge that we took in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, that's actually, if you understand its actual meaning, what you're doing is you're taking refuge in the fact that you can achieve that awakening, that the Dharma is a method that you can achieve that awakening in this lifetime, right now, that the Dharma provides the instruction that can take you there, and that the Sangha, all of the other people who are engaged in and following this path, with their support, it becomes much easier, and that by participating with the Sangha, it will enormously accelerate your progress and your ability to do that. As a matter of fact, the Buddha's cousin, who was also his personal attendant, Ananda, once said to the Buddha, he said, Sir, the Sangha, the community of noble practitioners, that's half of the spiritual life, is it not? And the Buddha said, No. No, don't say that, Ananda. It's the whole of the spiritual life, you know, emphasizing the importance of taking advantage of the Sangha to help support you in this. But anyway, the difference between a lot of these meditation techniques and the Buddhist meditation techniques is certain ideas that have been more fully developed, and in TM, you've done it. You know, you don't really get a lot of detail. It's a really simple method, and you're pretty much left to make it work on your own. You get some guidance in various ways. The idea of mindfulness, which is really central in Buddhist meditation, isn't talked about much in most other meditation methods. And mindfulness is something that is it's actually what it means. One way of putting it is to be able to fully utilize the power of your mind effectively, and to do that for more and more of the time. And you'll come across a lot of different definitions of mindfulness, which a lot of times the emphasis in discussing mindfulness is put on attention. You'll hear one definition that's pretty commonly presented is that mindfulness means paying attention. And people think of mindfulness as paying attention. But as I said to you earlier, that's the one thing we overdo. People are never not paying attention. So to define mindfulness as paying attention is a pretty weak definition. What makes it a lot stronger is if you say mindfulness is paying attention to the right things at the right time in the right way. Now you've got something that's far more powerful and useful. So it's paying attention to the right things. And this is where peripheral awareness comes in. And this faculty of awareness isn't usually clearly delineated. But it's the only way that you can pay attention to the right things at the right time is to have a very well-developed peripheral awareness. So that means that when you're in a situation, if you're mindful, you're not only using your attention to deal with the situation to accomplish whatever that you need to accomplish, but you have a powerful peripheral awareness that's causing you not to forget the context in which whatever's happening is happening, the larger context. And even more especially, the introspective aspect of awareness, so that you recognize what's going on in your mind. And the effect that this has is that awareness guides you to use your attention wisely. We tend, if you think about what happens, somebody says something to you and you get upset. Your attention is totally focused on what they said, how you feel, and what you're going to say back to them. And your awareness is basically zero. It's collapsed, you know. Whereas if you have mindfulness, yes, your attention is on what they said, but your attention is allowing you to perceive more than just as them as we don't see the real person in those moments. They become very one-dimensional. They become this one-dimensional source of this thing that they said that upset us. And we don't use our attention to try to put the words that we heard into the larger context of the person and their possible pain or fear or whatever else it is, or their desire to be happy or their desire to avoid being hurt or whatever. So we're not using our attention effectively. And peripheral awareness allows that to happen, because peripheral awareness allows us to remember where we are and who we're with and our relationship to them. So you think about what happens between couples and the kinds of things that they say to each other. And there's a big difference in what they say if they remember who it is that they're talking to, or if their mind has contracted this other person down to this one-dimensional entity that is the source of this offensive statement. And then the same thing is to have peripheral awareness of, to have introspective awareness of your own mind. Well, why am I reacting this way? Do I need to react this way? Are there other ways that I can react? The tendency is that we react quite automatically. You know, if you look at it, then you say, yeah, okay, I always react when this kind of situation comes up. I always react in a similar way. There's a pattern there, and it certainly hasn't worked in the past. And so mindfulness gives you that little space in which to recognize that, well, actually, I don't have to let the automatic pilot kick in and say the same thing that's going to produce the same response and lead to the same, you know, I don't have to play this thing out again. All of a sudden, there are options. When you have mindfulness, because attention and awareness are working together, and awareness doesn't collapse, and attention doesn't take over, then you have new options. You have new choices. You can see more clearly. You can even clearly see, you know, if you have enough mindfulness, you can clearly see that, oh, that not only does this habitual way of reacting not help and rather hurt, but I can see that it's actually coming from things that really have nothing to do with this situation. That really this situation is triggering me to essentially at some unconscious level, I'm reliving some situation from the past or some pattern of conditioning from my past that really has absolutely nothing to do with the room I'm in right now and the person I'm talking to right now. That kind of mindfulness, that kind of awareness has an even more powerful effect. I mean, when you have the mindfulness that allows you to see that you have choices and options, it allows you to modify your behavior in much better ways. But when you begin to see where these patterns come from, seeing them, being conscious of them, being fully conscious of them in a state of mindfulness, and directing your mindfulness at them, it changes them. Because the part of your mind that, you know, it sits there in a corner and it's basically asleep and not paying attention to what's going on around and who you've become and what you've become, until somebody says something like that to you. And then it's like it turns the on switch, it takes over, and it starts creating all these problems. But now what you're doing through mindfulness is you're sending a message back to that part of your mind that, you know, it usually it gets turned on, it does its thing, and then it goes back to sleep after it's created all these problems. But by applying mindfulness to it, that part of your mind changes. It says, hey, wait a minute. I'm not the same person I was when this pattern of behavior was established. Everything's changed. Everything's totally different. And not only that, I can see that this is not helping. Maybe when I learned to react this way the first time, maybe it helped. Maybe it was a good thing. But times have changed. Situations changed. I'm with a different person. I'm with a different situation and things like that. It actually transforms how you are inside. So this notion of mindfulness, it goes way beyond the idea that I'm going to sit here and meditate and get my mind calm and get my mind clear. You're actually developing your mental faculties in a very powerful way that's going to help you. It's going to help you bring about all kinds of transformations. So to the degree that you develop mindfulness, I mean, it's become very popular now, these 8-week mindfulness courses for people who have various problems and PTSD and things like that. And that's because if you become just a little bit more mindful than you usually are, then you do have this experience of seeing options, seeing that there's different ways that you can respond to the situation. And if you're lucky and your 8-week mindfulness training course worked well enough, it can help to even strongly moderate certain patterns of behavior that you develop so they don't take over to the degree that they used to. But believe me, that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's just what a little bit of mindfulness can do for a person. So, what attracted me to Buddhist meditation, and what to this day, the reason that I find it to be extremely valuable, and there's many different forms of Buddhist meditation, by the way, as well, is that this notion, the term, you know, we say meditation, the term that's actually used by Buddhists is translated to training the mind. So meditation isn't about getting to a nice state, it's about training your mind, right? You might have noticed this morning with the Refuge and Precepts. Sometimes I have these days when parts of my brain don't work too clearly, and one of the worst effects of that is that I can't remember words and names and things like that. So I can't remember the word that means to train the mind. But the Buddhist word for meditation means mind, mental training. And that's what we're doing. We're training our mind. We're increasing, basically, we have these two faculties, attention and awareness. And the degree to which we're able to employ both at once is a function of how much conscious power we have. And the mental training that we do increases our conscious power while at the same time training us to use both attention and awareness together. If you just practiced using an attention and awareness together, you'd still be limited by the amount of conscious power you have. It's like you've got a certain amount of energy going into two functions, and one of them can suck it all up, and the other one basically turns off. So in order to be able to use both of these conscious functions to their maximum benefit, you also have to increase the conscious power of your mind. And so that's what the practice does. It teaches you what mindfulness is and how to use it. And in the course of doing that, it also, that's one part of the mental training. The other part of the mental training is to increase the conscious power of your mind. It makes your mind much more powerful enough to sustain mindfulness even in difficult situations. So it's mental training. And not only does that mindfulness, as it grows more and more powerful, allow you to deal with a lot of the kind of problematic situations in your life, the tendencies you have, the everything, you know, addictive behaviors, and, you know, the whole list of things that we have. We could call those all the mundane benefits of meditation and mindfulness. And it has tons of mundane benefits. You know, the Buddha said of this Dharma, he said, it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, it's good in the end. So as soon as you start doing it, you start getting benefit. But the farther, the deeper, more deeply you go into it, the greater and the more profound those benefits are. So as your mindfulness becomes strong enough, you begin to have, you achieve insight. And what insight is to understand things about yourself and the world and your relationship to it in a much more deeper and accurate and more truthful and more real way than you ever have before, and than everybody else in the world does. So these kinds of insights, they're called supra-mundane. All these other benefits were mundane benefits. They were kind of worldly. They're kind of, you know, made you a better version of being the same as all the other people in the world, right? But the supra-mundane benefits, they're supra-mundane because you begin to see things in a totally different way than the average worldling. So supra, you've gone beyond the worldly, mundane. In your understanding, you've achieved a kind of wisdom. You are seeing things as they really are, and you are understanding your deepest nature as it really is. And when those insights come together, you know, there's a number of different insights. When they all come together, you undergo that transformation that's called awakening or enlightenment. So that's where mindfulness takes you if you keep on pursuing it, if you keep on going with it. So, and other meditation techniques can take you to the same place, but I know of none that even vaguely approach the systematic, even you could even call it scientific approach that the Buddha developed 2,500 years ago, and which is diversified into a variety of different techniques that people can use. It's not that Buddhism is offering something that you can't be achieved through by Christian mystics, by Sufis, by people practicing any of the many different religious and spiritual traditions in the world by shamans, so on and so forth. It's not that Buddhism somehow has the one avenue into this one special thing that nobody else has, although you might hear some ill-informed Buddhist present it that way. It's not the case. But I'm pretty well informed about these things, and my opinion is that in terms of a path that will get you there with the highest degree of certainty and most quickly, that's what Buddhist meditation has to offer. So, if you want to go there. Once again, it brings us back to what you want from meditation. A lot of very simple meditation techniques work very well for creating relaxation and helping you to deal with stress. Even when your meditation, if you meditate regularly once or twice a day, even if much of your meditation ends up in mind wandering, doing that is still going to produce more peace and calm and make it easier for you to deal with stress. So simpler meditation techniques have a value if what they give you suits the goal that you're after, then that's great. Like, you don't need a jet airplane to get to the corner store. A bicycle works just fine.
My name is Carolyn. I think it's working now.
Okay, good.
This is the third time I've been to Cochise Stronghold, and I actually don't remember the first time I came, but in walking this particular place on earth, it was clear to me that it is one of those places where there's an unusual collocation of energies that are pretty extraordinary in terms of purifying oneself, even if you're just being here without meditating.
That's right. Yeah.
Like both Sue and Jody spoke, I've dipped into various different kinds of meditation over many decades, but did have the experience of, for me, understanding that the Vipassana version of Buddhist meditation was the most profound for me. Mm-hmm. And there was a period in my life in the decade, I guess I'd say of my early 40s, when meditation played a really important place in my life in terms of keeping me able to be connected to the interiority of who I really am while holding pretty significant positions in the world that are quite toxic in terms of the kinds of energies that come at you on a regular basis. And I still do that kind of work in the world, although from less significant positions. And I have understood for a while that I need to be back into a more consistent meditation practice. But I found that very difficult to do. And it isn't that I don't understand, as Terry and I were talking yesterday, that even if you're just really antsy while you sit, it's important that you sit.
Yeah.
So, again, it's like Jody says, just serendipity for me that to be here at this moment this morning, and I'm sure whatever happens, it will be very good for me.
Oh, wonderful. It's so good to have you here, Carolyn. Thank you. And I know what you mean about if you want to do something important in this world with your life, and not that everybody wants to or necessarily that everybody should, but if you're one of those kinds of people who want to do things that make a difference, you have to place yourself in some pretty toxic situations. That's the name of the game. There's no no way you can avoid that. And that certainly is, you described it very well. That's one of the things that comes when you have achieved a certain degree of mindfulness, is that you can be in those toxic situations, and your mindfulness allows you to still be who you are and understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, not lose track of your values, and then do your best to deal with the situation that you're in. There's actually a name for that. It's called mindfulness with clear comprehension. And that it's a wonderful thing. But as you say, the problem with mental training is it's like physical training. You can lift weights and become, this super Hulk, and then you quit doing it for 10 years and you don't look any different than any other couch potato. And same thing happens with mindfulness training, is if you don't keep it up, you don't have the same resources to draw on when you find yourself in those difficult situations. So I'm so glad that you're getting back into it. And believe me, all the things that you had, let's use the word, mastered previously, may take a little while, but they'll come back a whole lot. It won't take nearly as long as it did the first time around to get to that same place. And I'm really happy that you're doing that. But you're also right, there's something very special about this place. And one of the things that you discover as your understanding and wisdom grows is that the view of the world that we typically experience, it's really a collective view that mankind has developed. And it represents an almost microscopically tiny sliver of the reality that we're a part of. And our minds function more to filter things out. We think of consciousness as our window on reality. It's not. Our mind is this filter that filters out most of reality, leaving only the little bit that's easy for us to make sense of and allows us to navigate, which is really an important thing, because if we didn't simplify things. I came across a really good analogy by someone who said that the world that we perceive is like what we see on our computer monitor, and we see this little picture of a file, and we see a little picture of a trash can in the corner of the screen, and our minds can handle that really, really well. We see that little image, that little icon of the file, and we know that that's the document with all the stuff that we wrote and everything. And we can change its name and move it around different places. And we know that if we drag it over to the trash, to the little trash can icon, that it will disappear. We also know that none of that is real. It's what it is. It's a make-believe version. That file that you wrote it consists of ones and zeros stored on a disk scattered all over the place. It doesn't even vaguely resemble that little folder that you see on the screen. And when you move it around or change its name or anything else, none of the things that you are doing bear even the remotest resemblance to what's really happening inside. And it's a really good thing, because you'd never be able to manage if your only way of perceiving things. So what our minds do is give us a really, really simplified version of the world that's easy to deal with. And a lot gets filtered out. And most children, I know I did, and I'll bet most of you did too, whether you recollect it yourself or whether it's something that your parents or grandparents or something told you, that when you were little, you used to see things and talk to beings and have relationships with them and stuff like that, your imaginary playmates, that's what your parents would have called them and everything. But the fact is that we learn that you don't see those things in order to fit into this world. And so you will have had some experience of your mind becoming that filter that cuts out the stuff that is not workable. Although there are some people who manage to grow up and live their whole lives with, they have a filter, but it lets a whole lot more in than other people do. And that gives them some pretty remarkable and wonderful abilities. Of course, if it's not well managed, it can have them ending up, living in cardboard boxes on the streets, too. But we all, it depends on how much of that sensitivity that you retain. And a lot of us can recognize that this world is full of beings in forms that we can't normally perceive, and that there are processes going on that we cannot be aware of that make certain places inherently sacred and other places equally seem to be bad places to spend very much time, and yet from the point of view of the consensual reality that we have learned and we share, there's no difference between this place and that place. How could this place has some nice mountains and some nice trees? I mean, yeah. So, but you have sensed that there is a power in certain places, and this is one of those places that has a lot of power. And we're extremely fortunate to be here. It's absolutely wonderful that we have the opportunity to be here, to live here, to spend our lives here, and then to bring other people here and share it with them. And that's one of the things that we share it with a whole lot of people that come just looking for a bed and breakfast, someplace to stay on vacation while they go and visit other places. But not all of them, but a lot of them feel it too. And a lot of them come here with all these plans for all these things that they're going to do for the next 3 days, and then they end up just staying here because of it. But then there's all the meditators and the people who, for whom spiritual practice is an important part of their life, and they come here and they realize that this is a place that is empowering for doing that kind of work. And so that's what we do, is we share it with other people in this way. Matter of fact, this week Nancy has a whole group of people coming in doing some 15 or 18 women or something like that, doing a meditation retreat with Irina Wiseman. So may not be the most perfectly designed facility for doing a retreat, but it has other things to offer.
Can we take a break?
Yeah, I think it's time for us to take a break. Well, I have one question. Is there anyone here that hasn't meditated before? Great. Okay, because I didn't want to have somebody who's never meditated before here sitting for 45 minutes. We're going to sit for 45 minutes. We're going to take a short break. I'll ring the gong when you come back. We'll sit for 45 minutes, and then we'll do some walking meditation. Does everybody know how to do walking meditation? Great. Okay. It's even better. And then we'll come back and we'll have another shorter sit before we have lunch. Okay? All right.